Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant, Katie Weaver, and Susan Shand. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Sometimes modern problems require ancient solutions. A 1,400-year-old Peruvian method of diverting water could supply up to 40,000 Olympic-size swimming pools worth of water to Lima each year. That information comes from a new study published in Nature Sustainability. It's one example of how ancient methods could support existing modern ones in countries without enough water. More than a billion people across the world face water shortages. Man-made reservoirs store rainwater and water overflow for use during drier times. But reservoirs are costly, require years to plan, and can still fail to meet water needs. Recently, for example, the reservoirs in Chennai, India, went almost dry. The city's 4 million people had to then depend on water transports from the government. Peru's capital, Lima, depends on water from rivers high in the Andes Mountains. It takes only a few days for water to flow down to the city. So, when the dry season begins in the mountains, the water supply quickly disappears. The city suffers shortages of 43 million cubic meters during the dry season. It resolves this with modern structures such as man-made reservoirs. These reservoirs are not the only solution, however. Over 1,000 years ago, indigenous people developed another way to solve water problems. Boris Ochoa Tokachi is a researcher at Imperial College London and lead writer of the study. He explored one of the last remaining water harvesting systems in the small mountain community of Huamantanga, Peru. The system was developed even before the ancient Inca civilization.
The 1,400-year-old system is designed to increase the water supply during the dry season by diverting and slowing water as it travels down the mountains. This nature-based method is made of special canals that guide water from its source to a series of water bodies and hillsides. The water goes slowly into the ground, then flows downhill through the soil and reappears in water bodies near the community. Its aim was to increase the water's travel time from days to months in order to provide water throughout the dry season. But Ochoa Tokachi said the amount of water that could be harvested was an unknown before the study. The researchers measured how much the system slowed the flow of water by injecting special dye in the highlands and noting when it reappeared in water bodies. The dyed water started to surface 2 weeks later and continued flowing for 8 months, a huge improvement over the hours or days it would normally take. I think probably the most exciting result is that we actually confirmed that this system works, Ochoa Tokachi said. It's not only trusting that, yeah, we know there are traditional practices. We know that indigenous knowledge is very useful. He said there is now proof the systems are valuable today and can be a tool to help solve modern problems.
The researchers next considered how using a larger version of the system could help Lima. They combined what they learned in Huamantanga with the knowledge of physical qualities of Lima's surroundings. The resulting estimates say the system could increase Lima's dry season water supply by 7.5% overall and up to 33% at the start of the dry season. This amounts to nearly 100 million cubic meters of water each year, equal to 40,000 Olympic-size swimming pools. Todd Gartner is director of the Natural Infrastructure Initiative at the World Resources Institute. He noted that this study takes what we often just talk about and it puts this into practice. He said it does a lot of evaluation and observation and puts real numbers behind it. The system is also economically sound. Ochoa Tokachi estimated that building canals similar to those in Huamantanga would cost 10 times less than building a reservoir of the same size. He also said former highland societies in other parts of the world had methods for diverting and slowing water flow. And they could use these methods today to support their costlier modern methods. I think there is a lot of potential in revaluing these water harvesting practices that have a very long history, Ochoa Tokachi said. He added that the idea of using indigenous knowledge for solving modern engineering problems is probably very valuable today. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Katie Weaver. Former Pink Floyd musician David Gilmour sold his guitar collection last month for $21.5 million at an auction to raise money for needy organizations. The collection included his well-known Black Strat Fender Stratocaster. It was sold for nearly $4 million to the owner of a U.S. National Football League team. The sale set a musical instrument record. It came just a few weeks after the company Sotheby's sold Mule, a painting by Claude Monet, for $110 million, a record price for an Impressionist painting. And it is not just instruments and paintings that are being bought by rich people around the world. The longest U.S. economic expansion in history has brought news of big spending. It also has raised concerns about the distance between the rich and everyone else. For some people, the high price of some goods is a sign of too much wealth.
The bank UBS says the number of billionaires in the United States has increased from 267 in 2008 to 607 in 2018. The rich have gotten richer, and they've gotten richer faster, said John Matthews. He is the head of private wealth management and ultra-high net worth at UBS Global Wealth Management. But there are signs of problems at lower income levels. Information from the U.S. Central Bank suggests that by 2016, the richest 20% of Americans held 88% of the country's wealth. The federal government says that more than 39 million people need to use food assistance programs. That is not as many as the high of over 47 million in 2013. But still, it is up 40% from 2008. At the same time, the country's population has only grown about 8%. The U.S. economy has expanded a record-setting 121 months. That means the economy has been growing continuously for over 10 years. And it has been more than 10 years since the financial crisis of 2007 to 2008. At that time, some people worried about the future of the financial system and even of capitalism. As a result, the U.S. government moved quickly to calm markets and lower interest rates after the U.S. housing market collapsed. But many people are concerned that efforts at that time did little to deal with income and wealth inequality. Now, some worry that high costs and overspending could lead to another kind of financial crisis. The term, the wealth effect, is sometimes used to describe how people spend more freely when they have a lot of money. The examples of higher prices or values are big and small. The cost of a dinner at the French Laundry, a popular California restaurant, is up 35% to $325 per person. The U.S. stock market has gone up more than 200% in the last 10 years. Investor Ken Griffin set a record in January when he bought a home for nearly $238 million near New York's Central Park. The website StreetEasy.com says rents in New York have risen 2 times faster than pay from 2010 to 2017. This can make it hard for lower-income people to find a place to live. U.S. home prices are higher than they were during the financial crisis. The group Coalition for the Homeless says the number of people sleeping in shelters is 70% higher than it was 10 years ago. The housing opportunity for them is not getting any better, said Carolyn Valley. She is CEO at Central Berkshire Habitat for Humanity in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. The organization builds houses for the poor. She said high health care costs and a lack of large employers mean fewer jobs in some areas. Food and housing costs remain high. Some economic policymakers worry that the gains made by low-income people in the last 10 years will be lost. Employment, however, remains strong. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reported the most recent unemployment rate at 3.6% for May. That is one of the lowest rates of unemployment in U.S. history. I'm Susan Shand.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of President George Herbert Walker Bush. He was elected the 41st President of the United States in 1988. George H.W. Bush was president when the Cold War ended between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Cold War had lasted more than 40 years. Both sides were heavily armed with nuclear weapons. People worried that one wrong move could lead to the end of the world. But by the late 1980s, the world was changing. The Soviet Union was dying. On November 9, 1989, East Germany opened the Berlin Wall for the first time since it had been built. The wall had divided communist East Germany from democratic West Germany since 1961. Citizens and soldiers together soon began tearing it down. Tensions continued to ease as communist rule in most of the former Soviet republics ended by the early 1990s. 15 republics had belonged to the Soviet Union. By the end of 1991, most had declared their independence. They became a loosely formed group called the Commonwealth of Independent States. Countries that had considered the United States their enemy now looked to it to lead the way to peace and, they hoped, prosperity. As the Soviet Union was dying, President Bush repeatedly negotiated with Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. One of those meetings took place in the spring of 1990 in the United States. It led to an agreement calling for both sides to destroy most of their chemical weapons. The two leaders also agreed to increase trade relations. The American and Soviet presidents met in Moscow in July 1991. There, they signed the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, known as START 1. This treaty called for both sides to reduce their numbers of long-range nuclear weapons. They promised to cut the number by about one-third over 7 years. START 1 became the first agreement between the two powers to order cuts in existing supplies of nuclear weapons. In September 1991, President Bush said the United States would remove most of its short-range nuclear weapons from service. He also said the United States would destroy many of them. The next month, the Soviets announced that they would do the same. On December 25th of that year, Mikhail Gorbachev resigned as president as the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics came to an end.
Compatriots, due to the situation which has evolved as a result of the formation of the Commonwealth of Independent States, I hereby discontinue my activities at the post of President of the USSR.
6 months earlier, Russians had chosen Boris Yeltsin as the first democratically elected leader of Russia. When the Soviet Union collapsed, he became the most important leader of the former republics. President Bush and President Yeltsin signed another Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, START 2, in January 1993.
Fellow citizens, last night I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama. No president takes such action lightly.
One of George Bush's military actions as president was to send troops into Panama in December 1989. They captured the country's leader, General Manuel Noriega. The United States had charged Noriega with drug trafficking. He had also refused to honor election results that showed another candidate winning the presidency. President Bush said he also sent troops to the Central American nation to protect the 35,000 Americans living there. The American troops easily defeated Noriega's forces. He was taken to the United States, where he was tried, found guilty, and sent to prison for many years. The United States then supported the presidency of Guillermo Endara, the winner of the election in Panama.
Five months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait. Tonight, the battle has been joined.
In August 1990, Iraq invaded its neighbor, Kuwait. The United Nations Security Council passed a resolution threatening war on Iraq unless it withdrew from Kuwait. The council set a deadline of January 15, 1991. But Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein refused. The United States and other nations were receiving much of their oil from Kuwait and neighboring Saudi Arabia. President Bush succeeded in forming a coalition with 38 other countries against Iraq. The purpose was to free Kuwait and protect Saudi Arabia against a possible Iraqi invasion.
This military action, taken in accord with United Nations resolutions and with the consent of the United States Congress, follows months of constant and virtually endless diplomatic activity on the part of the United Nations, the United States, and many, many other countries. Arab leaders sought what became known as an Arab solution, only to conclude that Saddam Hussein was unwilling to leave Kuwait. Others traveled to Baghdad in a variety of efforts to restore peace and justice. Our Secretary of State, James Baker, held an historic meeting in Geneva, only to be totally rebuffed. This past weekend, in a last-ditch effort, the Secretary General of the United Nations went to the Middle East with peace in his heart, his second such mission, and he came back from Baghdad with no progress at all in getting Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait.
Coalition forces began an air war against Iraq on January 17, 1991. They bombed Iraqi targets in Iraq and Kuwait. On February 23rd, the Iraqis set fire to hundreds of Kuwaiti oil wells.
It looks like what I envisioned hell would look like. The country of Kuwait is burning.
The coalition had the long and difficult task of putting those fires out. On February 24th, the Allied ground war began as part of the operation known as Desert Storm. That ground war lasted just 100 hours. Saddam Hussein withdrew his forces from Kuwait, but he was still in control of his own country. Years later, some Americans continued to criticize the Bush administration for not trying to oust the Iraqi leader. They believe that Bush should have sent forces to capture Baghdad, the Iraqi capital. After the war ended, Kurds in northern Iraq rebelled against Saddam Hussein. So did Shiite Muslims in southern Iraq. The Iraqi government crushed both uprisings. The defeated Kurds fled to Iran and Turkey and into the mountains of northern Iraq. President Bush ordered American troops to help give humanitarian aid to the refugees. The troops established refugee camps for the Kurds. As time passed, Iraqi soldiers and aircraft continued to attack the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south. Coalition forces led by the United States established no-fly zones barring Iraqi aircraft over northern and southern Iraq. Coalition planes enforced these no-fly zones in the years that followed. By late 1992, drought and conflict had caused widespread suffering in Somalia.
I want to talk to you today about the tragedy in Somalia and about a mission that can ease suffering and save lives. Every American has seen the shocking images from Somalia. The scope of suffering there is hard to imagine. Already, over 250,000 people have died in the Somali famine. In the months ahead, five times that number. 1.5 million people could starve to death.
The violence and the collapse of the government were keeping many Somalis from receiving food and other aid.
The security situation has grown worse. The UN has been prevented from deploying its initial commitment of troops. In many cases, food from relief flights is being looted upon landing. Food convoys have been hijacked. Aid workers assaulted. Ships with food have been subject to artillery attacks that prevented them from docking. There is no government in Somalia. Law and order have broken down. Anarchy prevails. One image tells the story. Imagine 7,000 tons of food aid literally bursting out of a warehouse on a dock in Mogadishu while Somalis starve less than a kilometer away, because relief workers cannot run the gauntlet of armed gangs roving the city.
President Bush, in the last year of his term, sent American troops to Somalia to assist in the aid efforts. But the following year, in October of 1993, 18 American soldiers on a raid were killed in a battle in Mogadishu. More than 80 others were wounded. That failed operation would haunt the American military for years to come. The events of that day were the basis for the book and movie Black Hawk Down. In December of 1992, as Bush was about to leave office, he and the leaders of Canada and Mexico signed the North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA called for removing taxes and other barriers to trade in North America. Some Americans accused Bush of sacrificing American jobs to lower-paid workers in Mexico by supporting NAFTA. Others praised him for supporting the agreement, which still had to pass Congress. But by the time it did, George Bush was no longer president. He had lost his campaign for a second term. In November of 1992, he lost the election to the Democratic governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.